Thanks, Beth, for that lovely meditation, worthy of mentioning 350 million years. This makes 1 minute of silence, puts that in perspective a bit. So anyway, so lovely to see all of you. As I said before, I want to continue our series. We're closing the door on 12 words for 12 months. That's what we've been doing, if you've been paying attention. And this month is the word sacred. And what did I learn last week about giving a talk on sacred? I realized, this drags up some stuff for some people. And it's a very interesting word, which is only in sort of encourages me to keep going. Not that I want to make you upset. But it stirs around in things. For some of us, it's stirred up kind of some religious hangover stuff. Like, ooh, I don't know how I feel about a word like sacred. And for others, it sort of brought up a longing, like, is anything sacred anymore? And if so, what? And what rubric do we use? And is sacred just a matter of personal opinion? What do we hold collectively as sacred? These are some of the questions that were coming out of last week. And I remember in the talk back, I mentioned something. I said, it's funny that even though we live in an increasingly, I'm going to use some words here that might continue to give us trouble, but let's just call it a secular society for the time being, an increasingly secular society. That's kind of an old way of putting it. But words that are religious in nature, like a word like sacred, still crop up anyway. Like, if you were paying attention when we were all voting, I kept hearing on the news about the sacred right to vote. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. That's a religious way of putting it. Remember what I said last week to begin with was sacred means set apart, set apart as something other. Is that the way you view voting? And during January 6th, during the riots, I remember hearing about that the sacred halls of Congress. And I thought, it's a very curious way of putting it. Does that mean that Congress people and senators are saints? Is that what it means? Yeah, of course, you laugh, And actually, Leslie said something that was very powerful. She said, well, it's not the Congress people, obviously, and it's not really even the building, but it's the ideal that is somehow encapsulated, or it's a symbol of the ideal, is probably the way I would put it. It's a symbol of the ideal. And that's kind of what I want to hover around today. It's the question of ideals. And are any of our ideals sacred, so to speak? And I'm going to use air quotes because, again, it's a challenging word. But are our ideals, how much do we hold them as something set apart would be the right way of putting it? And to set something apart is to make a distinction. And if I want to be even more clear, it's to say this is better than that. And actually that can make us a little bit uncomfortable in the really postmodern world we find ourselves in. Is one thing better than another? Is one idea better than another? Is one set of ideals better than another or more sacred than another or set apart? I'm not going to answer all of these questions. I just want to try to raise them today. And I thought it was today I'm going to try to do something that is going to be kind of personally challenging for me. And that's to talk a bit about 9/11 and the 20 years that have passed since that day. How many of you, I'm just curious, can sort of vividly remember what was going on for you that day? Yeah, okay, me too. I was living in East Grand Rapids, renting a little house, and I went to Starbucks. I had a 6-month-old baby who's now 20, which is wild. And it was one of those days in September where you're like, I am just glad to be alive, where the humidity has dropped and the air has that certain quality, and even the light is different in September. And it was one of those days. And I remember hearing chatter at Starbucks that something was going on. And I came home and I turned on NPR because we didn't have a TV because I'm more righteous than other people. Just the whole day just leveled us. You know, what a day. And 20 years does seem like something important to mark and to do some introspection, really. What have we been doing these 20 years? What questions did the problem of 9/11 really raise, and have we been addressing them? Because on the one hand, it's a time to grieve and to remember, which is really important, to grieve and to remember the loss of human life and the disruption, really to who we thought we were in the world. It was a shock. And it's also a time to say, well, what ideals are at war? Because after all, we've been engaged in something that we've called the war on terror for 20 years. What is that? And is it just a military engagement? Is that what the war on terror is? What about the philosophical dimensions? The question of ideals and how we should live and what we value as a society and as a culture versus other kinds of things. Do you see how this is kind of challenging and hard to talk about? So I want to try to do it a little bit this morning, but I want you to hear me say at the beginning that I'm trying to walk in a humble way toward these questions because I think they're important. And I'm not going to deliver, you know, big answers here, but just try to raise the right kind of questions. Like, what really is at stake here? And here's a question that's kind of hard to know the answer. Has religious extremism gotten worse or better in the war of ideas? Actually, I don't know. I mean, that's a genuine question. Has it gotten worse or better? I don't know. Have we done a good job fighting, so to speak, the ideological war? Not just the wars that we've waged on the ground. You know, these are questions I think that are hard. And I want to raise something about how our kind of postmodern suspicion, which I like to pick on from time to time, how it's been serving us. So what I mean by postmodern suspicion is something like this. No truth is any more true than anyone else's truth. Or your way of seeing things is no better or worse than my way of seeing things. And by the way, I think it's important to acknowledge that there's some epistemological humility in that idea. Would you agree? I mean, epistemology meaning how we come to know anything. And that's one of the great gifts of postmodernism. It says, don't be so arrogant. Don't be so narcissistic. Don't think that just because you think something that you're right. You might be full of illusions and fantasies. So take that down a notch and say, well, maybe my perspective isn't the only one valid at the table. However, in its most extreme form, we tend to flatten everything out. No worldview or idea or religion or perspective is any better or worse than another one. And that gets us into trouble, especially when it comes to what happened to us 20 years ago. So it's hard. It's hard to think about these things. And I think challenging. So I want to go back in time here for a few minutes. And I want to talk to us a little bit about what I see as kind of an evolution in consciousness and kind of the doorstep of where we are now. Now, I'm taking some big generalizations here. These are broad, sweeping statements about history for a moment, but bear with me. I was once called, I did a program for the Discovery Channel like a few years ago, and they put on the screen Kent Dobson, historian. I thought, what does it take to be a historian? I know, just a little thing that says historian. That's all it is. So I may have a master's degree in history, but I don't know if that makes me a historian. So, but I do want to talk about something that I think is interesting. If we go back into earlier human cultures, both nation states, villages, and tribes, we have an almost universal idea. I'm saying almost because I'm trying to have some humility here. There may have been some exceptions. We don't know of them. But here's what they had in common: that sacred, that the sacred was fixed in a place. Okay? Places were sacred. Because they thought, for one reason or another, the god or the gods dwelled there, lived there, made it sacred in some way, like rivers and streams and mountains and eventually sites that were associated with that became either temples or altars or outdoor shrines or things like this, seems to be pretty universal. And that's important to recognize if we're going to have a conversation about what is sacred, that originally, way back there, place more than anything else is what mattered. This place is sacred. And when I say sacred, set apart. We're going to do ordinary things over here, but we're going to do sort of holy things over here. And if we figure out the right relationship to this place, we'll be in right relationship to the god or to the gods. Have I made sense? It's not that, I mean, it might sound a bit primitive to you, but it is a way of answering the question, how do I relate to the mystery of life? Are all places the same or are they not the same? If I approach certain places humbly and with respect, does that benefit me in the community in some way? And you might be thinking in the old way, like, I'm going to please God and God's going to make it rain and things like that. Yes, that was a dimension of that, but I'm just talking about how do we relate to the mystery of life itself? And sacred places were the universal cultural answer for that among human communities. Have I made sense so far? That's premise number one. It changed over time. And it started actually with Judaism. It may have been happening in other religions as well, but we don't have as much of a record as other religions. So something very interesting happened in 586 BC. I'm sure you were thinking about it this morning. And that is the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem, 586 BC, by the Babylonians. The Babylonians were a huge empire. The nation of Israel, I guess they would have been called, was just tiny. Tiny, like nobody in the grand scheme of things. The Babylonians just wiped everybody out. So anyway, they swept across the land of Israel as they were on their way to Egypt and destroyed the first temple in 586 BC. Now, what happened to most religions when they were conquered and their sacred places were conquered is that the religion disappeared? I mean, how many followers of Ra do you know? You know, or Mithra for that matter, which is one of the largest religions ever, Mithra. You might even be wondering, what is Mithra? I'm not going to tell you. Okay. Or the Mayan people for that matter. So usually when the place gets ruined, it's very hard for the religion to survive. Why? Because we can't be there. That's why. And like God lives over there in God's little house, and the little house is gone. That's really all a temple is a house for the god to live in. And when it's gone, then you're like, oh no. So here's what began to shift, starting with Judaism. They figured out how to be a religion without a temple. Now, they did rebuild it, but then it got destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. So they had another go at it. But that is very fascinating. And it did in part shift to a book, like meaning the Torah. And once you shift to a book as giving you some guidance, it's portable, right? You can't destroy it. And even if it got burned, you can memorize it. It doesn't matter. It's completely portable. And that is an evolution in human relationship to the word like sacred. That means I can worship my God in the way that I see fit, and I don't need the special place. It's nice to have the special place, but I can do it at home. Or I can do it in a synagogue, or I can do it. So do you understand what I'm saying? This is a monumental shift in people's relationships to a word like sacred. You begin to carry it around differently. And even when the second temple was destroyed in 70 by the Romans, the rabbis said something amazing. They said, the altar that stands in Jerusalem is now the Sabbath table. That's profound, you know? That's profound. So big shift in consciousness, we could say. Christianity really mimicked Judaism in this respect. And you have it with the words of Paul. Paul said, God does not live in temples made by human hands. That's in the book of Acts. Now, we just read that and be like, oh, that makes sense. I'm telling you, monumental leap in consciousness, in human consciousness, in the question of how do we relate to what's sacred? How do we relate to what's set apart? And we're on the way to holding religion really as ideals. That's the kind of direction. I'm making some major leaps here, but that's the kind of direction I'm going. Religious ideas and ideals, not just place and special places set apart, which is kind of problematic when it comes to the big tensions between the West and Islamic fundamentalism, which is a challenging thing to talk about. One of the reasons why 9/11 happened had to do with sacred space. The premise was, Western foreigners should not be on sacred lands, which belong to a real and partially imagined Islamic empire. So get out of our space. That's related to land. Isn't that, I mean, we forget that, but I'm saying it's important to say out loud and not forget that that was part of the question at hand. You don't have the right to be here. Certain people are allowed to live in certain holy places, and if you're not of that people, you don't have the right to live in those places or be in those places. Have I made sense? Now, you can agree or disagree, but it's part of the idealism that is at war with the idealism of the West. It's a clash of worldviews, big time. Centered on sacred space, believe it or not. We think, oh, that was so long ago. Who cares about sacred space? It's so present that we were all remembering it yesterday. And this is a bit of an aside, it's interesting how these places that experience so much suffering and destruction, like the Twin Towers and like the Pentagon and like Pennsylvania, have become like sacred places for us. Why? Because something happened there, that's place, but I think more importantly to the question Leslie was raising, to the ideals to which it represents. The ideals to which it represents. And we ought to be asking something like, what's our conversation with these ideals? And how much are we committed to them? And what are they? And I'm going to try to name some of them in a few minutes. All right, let me look at my notes. One of the things that happened to me during COVID is that I needed glasses. So, let me see here. What'd you say? Well, welcome to the rest of your life. That's what I heard. Okay, here's something I wanted to say. So, speaking of ideals and ideas, 9/11 was an attack on three real places and symbols. The Trade Center is about money, and global market forces situated in a certain place in the world, meaning New York. The Pentagon is quite obvious. That's military might, you could say. And what, although there's some debate about this, the Flight 93 that went down to Pennsylvania was on the way to, we don't know exactly, but White House, Congress, we don't know, but something like that seemed to be the case. And that's the center of our power, really, we could say. So I just want you to hear that. Money, military, and power. I mean, you cannot think of, if you say anything at all about the people who were the masterminds of this, this was intentional. This was not an accident, and these were chosen for a reason. And I want you to ask yourself a question. Is that how you think about America? Is the core of our ideals money, military, and power? Now, I'm not saying we don't have those things, but does that make you kind of uncomfortable? Like when you put, maybe you do, maybe you don't, but like Memorial Day, you put a flag out, do you just stand out there and be like, all about money? I'm all about, whoa, power? I'm all about military? No, I don't think so. And I think really, if I'm generous, I think the vast majority of Americans believe in some other things. And so it raises the question, then what is at the core of our society and our culture? And even though we do have a lot more money than other cultures, we have a lot more power, and we have really unbelievable amounts of military power, and a lot of it's hidden from us. We don't even know most of the time what the military is up to. Anyway, all that is true, we could say, but is that the only thing? And is that the thing that's worth preserving? And what I'd like to suggest, this is my humble suggestion, is I'm not saying tear down the military, let's just, you know, give all of our arms away, and you know, no, okay, the world is a dangerous place, but I'm asking, is that really the ideals that we would like to live by and promote as a culture? And I think most people would say, no, I don't think so. And what I'm suggesting is 9/11 raises these kinds of questions. So I'm asking, what does America stand for? I mean, really, what does it stand for? And maybe I should also ask this. What is our moral stance in the world? Let's say we do have a lot of money, and we have a lot of military might, and we have a lot of power. What's our moral stance in the world? Or do we not care anymore? Because morality also carries a certain amount of weight. Wouldn't you agree? And oftentimes, and I thought about this when we were celebrating and remembering and honoring all the ordinary people that tried to help on 9/11, you know? I was celebrating the ordinariness of it. And that was rooted in moral character, not in power. People who went into buildings because of moral character. Not because like, oh, this could be a good chance to get in a good workout going up these stairs. None of that. Do you hear what I'm saying? Okay. Time for the glasses. So I'd like to suggest that 9/11 was an attack on our worldview. And it was questioning our moral stance and even our values. And something that has disturbed me that I want to try to say out loud. In the 20 years, and I would love to hear your, not right this second, but hear your feedback on this. In the 20 years since this has happened, have we grown more cynical about who we are or less? In just the 20 years since this has happened, how do we feel about ourselves? And I think the reason why I chose the word cynicism is because there's a time to be critical, and I think we're at an age where America needs to look at its shadow side. That's the way I would put it. I like to use psychological terms with this. America has a shadow. Don't be too surprised because you have a shadow too. And it's hard to look at. And we're being asked by our young people, by our culture, by protesters to look at the shadow. Look, see what's true. Try to integrate that. Try to pick that up. That's the role of depth psychology. I'm just borrowing integration. You integrate parts of this. You say, yes, I own this, and you pull it back out of the shadow. But what sometimes happens when you start to look at the shadow is that you get sucked into cynicism, bitterness, and ultimately a kind of nihilism. America is not worth anything. It doesn't have any kind of moral or ethical leg to stand on. It's all broken. It's all gross. It's nothing but power games, oppressing marginalized people. You can go down that road so far that you almost delight in its own downfall. And I'm saying, really, that's where we are as a culture. We're on that kind of precipice. Personally, if you want to know Kent Dobson's opinion, not that people are going to be flocking to my opinion, it's not the path that I think would do us much good or the world. I think rather, yes, it's time to do some shadow integration, but it's also time to look again at our ideals and values and say, what do we really value, and do we think this is worth promoting, and do we want our citizens to live in as much freedom and peace as possible, or will we get sucked into the nihilism that there's really nothing here? Do you understand what I'm asking? Okay. So, I decided to challenge myself, and I'm going to give you my own way of stating some of the ideals and values that I think are worth fighting for without quoting from the Constitution or quoting from Abraham Lincoln or quoting from anybody. I'm just putting this in my own words, okay? And I challenge you to put some things in your own words. We have a religious freedom here that is rooted in respect of differences. That would be my way of putting it. And I think this is valuable. There is religious freedom here to be religious or non-religious, and it's rooted in differences. And that's quite different than much of the world. It is. Now, there always is a paradox here, because as soon as you say we value differences, you might bump into some differences that you don't like, and you might bump into some differences that don't value differences. So it's a challenging thing to hold. It's always shot through with some irony and some paradox, but I think it's still worth something. Here's something else, my way of putting it. Individual human freedom matters, and human beings are not dispensable. They're not dispensable for some cause. But individual human lives and human freedom really matters. I think, yep, I believe that to be true, and parts of the world do not believe that. And I say, let's engage in an ideological debate about these things. Something like that. Here's another one. Human beings are bent toward consolidation of power. I don't think it will ever be anything other than that. Human beings are bent toward consolidation of power. You don't believe me? Go to a junior high playground when they pick teams for kickball, and you'll see consolidation of power, all right? It's in us, it's in us. The American experiment came along and said, it's in us, and what if from time to time we gave as many people as possible a say in how that power gets consolidated? That's my definition of democracy, I guess. Do you feel how that is, talk about a shift in consciousness. Something like that has never happened, as far as we know, in the history of the human race. Really, what I just described, where they said, we're going to give as many people, not even Greece. And Greece was pretty close. We got a lot of ideas from Greece, through the French philosophers, of course. But anyway, boom. We're going to check that power somehow from time to time. And I think this is an ideal worth promoting, even if they're if we don't always live up to it, which is obvious. One more thing. Everyone can get an education regardless of zip code or skin color. Now, have we always lived up to that? No? Have we made, if you're very honest, have we made tremendous strides in that direction? Go back 100 years. Go back 50 years. Yeah. Read Barack Obama's memoir sometime. It's surprising. Dreams of My Father, or Dreams from My Father, that one. I remember reading it and like just being surprised. How does a mixed race kid go to Harvard? He didn't have really the on-ramp that many other people do. And that's worth celebrating. Is it perfect right now? No. But think about the ideal of everyone can get an education regardless of zip code. It's a pretty powerful ideal. And it's not universal on this planet. Okay, so what is sacred? I'm almost done. What is sacred? This is one sentence that I'm trying from my own opinion. I'm going to say all human beings deserve to live as free as possible, regardless of their class, race, religion, or no religion. Something about that strikes me as set apart. All human beings deserve to live as free as possible, regardless of class, race, religion, or no religion. And this requires care for other people. That's what's so interesting about that. People should be free, and for that to happen, you have to care about other people and their freedoms. And I'm going to talk about another week the tension between personal freedom and the freedom of the community, because those things are intention. When are personal freedoms set aside for the benefit of others? Those are challenging things. But to me, that's an ideal that's constellated somehow in the American experiment. And I think we ought not to be too quick to throw it out. I have more, but I feel like this seems like a pretty good place to stop. There's a long way to go in the things I'm just describing. There's a long way to go. But it's a communal thing, you know? We have to keep these questions and these ideas in front of us. And maybe my final word is, let's be humble and keep the good in mind as we take steps forward. Thanks for listening.